an ungentlemanly act. The roots of the tragedy that were to befall William Smith go back some years before the moment during which he briefly savoured his great cartographic triumph. It was a morning during the early spring of 1808, 7 years before publication day, when a small delegation of worthy and distinguished Londoners arrived at the front door of William Smith's Riverside House on Buckingham Street. He had invited them there to make an official inspection tour, to see for themselves two things that were currently setting all scientific London on fire, and this at a time when geology, suddenly, was a new, exciting, and very fashionable science. They had been asked first to see the enormous collection of fossils that Smith had brought up from his former home in Bath, and had cleverly arranged, in the order of their appearance in the strata, as he put it, in cabinets in his otherwise empty dining room. And they had been invited also, or maybe this was their own idea, the records do not say, to make, at least ostensibly, a critical appraisal of the great new geological map on which Smith was then said to be engaged. If they had secondary and more sinister reasons for examining the map, they did not let Smith know. It was for him, in any case, an important and an intimidating encounter, a formal examination of his half-made map by members of the newly instituted Geological Society of London, of which as yet William Smith had not been invited to become a member. It was crucial, at least from Smith's point of view, that the meeting went well. Not only could the Society's members help him, they could also welcome him into their congenial midst and accelerate his progress into the very centre of Britain's geological establishment. The visiting party was led by a young man of undoubted distinction. His name was George Bellis Greenough, and the lacquered brougham that brought him and his companions to the Strand had come from the House of Commons, where he was, though only 30, a sitting member for a comfortable Surrey constituency. He was a man of immense wealth, and was at the time building for himself a large Italianate mansion on the fashionable west side of Nash's newly laid-out Regent's Park. Everything about Greenough, from his dandyish clothes and comportment to his formal manner and conversation, marked him as a gentleman. He was in rank and reputation as different from William Smith as it was possible to be, yet few knew the source of his family fortune, and the man who would go on to be the first president of the newly formed Geological Society, and was for the time being chairman, a post long since abolished, was at pains to conceal his ungentlemanly origins. In fact, his maternal grandfather had been in trade as a quack apothecary, and Greenough's liver pills were a popular remedy for a range of maladies from chronic flatulence to simple low spirits. But they made him a fortune, all of which was in due course passed on to George while he was a student at Eton when the grandfather died. There had been only one condition attached to the will, that though George had been born a Bellas, his pillmaker grandfather's gift was accompanied by a request that the boy bear the Greenough name in perpetuity. George Bellis Greenough was an archetype of the small group of men that had come together 6 months before with the aim of creating a social and dining club to be called the Geological Society of London, for the purpose, as the original manifesto proclaimed, of making geologists acquainted with each other, of stimulating their zeal, of inducing them to adopt one nomenclature, of facilitating the communication of new facts, and of contributing to the advancement of geological sciences. The society today is immense. It has 9,000 members, and is generally reckoned to be authoritative, academically rigorous, and contentedly Catholic in its membership. Back when the society was formed at the Freemasons' Tavern in London, on November the 13th, 1807, it was anything but. Its 13 founding members, "We are forming a little talking geological dinner club, of which I hope you'll be a member," went the invitation written by Sir Humphrey Davy, were first and foremost cultured dilettantes, though admittedly visionary ones. Most of them were wealthy. All were possessors, though mostly for their value as modish drawing-room accessories, of cabinets of fossils and collections of pretty minerals, and in the fields of geology and mineralogy, all except one were rank, if leisured, amateurs. Four of them were doctors. Three were chemists. One of them was William Allen, co-founder of the firm of Allen and Hanbury, which still makes cough lozenges today. Another was Davy, the isolator of sodium and potassium, and inventor of the miner's safety lamp. Two were printers and booksellers. These were the brothers Richard and William Phillips, the latter being the society's actual founder. One was a minister in the Unitarian Church. At least several of the other founders were Quakers, suggesting a degree of freedom from the intellectual stranglehold of religious dogma, even in those early days. And there was one wealthy and entirely independent man, George Belus Greenough. The only one of them who was a practicing mineralogist — geology had generally been called mineralogy until the middle of the 18th century — was Jacques-Louis Comte de Bournon, a Frenchman who had fled to London during the Terror, had changed his name to James Lewis, and had established a profitable business organizing and classifying the mineral and fossil collections of London's great and good, as well, as it happens, as laying out the diamond collection of the fabulously wealthy collector Sir Abraham Hume. Of this group, at least the Unitarian minister, a man named Arthur Aikin, knew William Smith and his work. Aikin was himself something of an amateur cartographer, and had a good knowledge of the topography of Shropshire and of its outcrops of minerals. There had been a half-hearted attempt by John Ferry to bring the two men, Smith and Aikin, together, in the hope of speeding up the progress of the map. It came to nothing, however, but it was quite probably Aikin who proposed to his brother members that, having received the invitation from Smith, they go down to Buckingham Street and see exactly what he was doing, even though, quite pointedly, they had not invited him to join the society in the first place. It seems appalling and cruel from this viewpoint that Smith was not seized upon as an ideal member of the early society. But a roll call of the men who were offered membership in those first few years indicates why. Greenough, Aikin, Babington, Pepys, and their colleague founders wanted men very much like themselves to join their little talking dinner club, elegantly distinguished men such as those who were speedily admitted, men like Lords Oriel, Seymour, and Seaforth, the Bishop of Carlisle, Sir James Hall, Sir Abraham Hume, Sir Thomas Sutton, the soon-to-be Sir Francis Beaufort, the Right Honourable George Knox, David Ricardo, later an MP, the Reverends Edward Burrow, Matthew Raine, George Sampson, and, the greatest humiliation of all for Smith, his old friend and benefactor from Bath, the Reverend Benjamin Richardson. But Smith himself simply would not do. In the eyes of the Greenoughs and the Sir James Halls of the world, he was unpolished and ill-educated. He didn't know how to dress or to dine. His accent had the common and rounded vowels of Oxfordshire. His efforts, however laudable, had not rendered him sufficiently wealthy. He'd probably find it difficult to manage the fees, and certainly wouldn't wish to spend the regular 15 shillings charged for a society dinner. Neither, it was noted with asperity, had he married well enough to counter the unfortunate circumstances of his rustic birth. The simple fact that he was dependent for his living on the practical applications of geology, on drainage and surveying and the holding back of the sea, meant that he was wholly unsuitable to mingle with men who liked to debate in contented languor over the competing virtues of Neptunism and Plutonism, or who looked at fossils for their beauty rather than for their usefulness in determining, as Smith did, which rocks were older than others. Nor, it was charged, was Smith an admirer of Abraham Werner, the Saxon geologist whose theory that all rocks had been precipitated from the sea, Neptunism, had convinced many of the founders of the London-based society. There was a good chance, Greenough and his colleagues believed, that Smith had never in fact heard of Werner, a further indication of the rough-hewn, artless ways of the man, which would sit ill with the manners of such learned figures as had already been asked to join. The fact that Wernerian theory was soon shown to be arrant nonsense cut little ice. His methods, the so-called continental methods, were those followed by large numbers of those London geologists who liked to think of themselves as au courant. Rude provincials like Smith were condemned by the Wernerian elite and generally regarded with contempt. And if all this were not enough, why, Smith was a friend and protégé of Sir Joseph Banks, and Banks had argued long and loud that the Geological Society should not be created separate from the Royal Society itself, the grandfather of all London learned societies, and the one of which Banks was still the president. He tried to change the Geological Society's constitution, and when he failed, resigned his membership and walked off in a huff. Certainly, Greenough and Hall were to say, no friend of Sir Joseph Banks should thus find it easy to become a member of their dinner club, particularly if he was socially unacceptable and not a true believer in the ways of Herr Werner of Freiburg. There was tension then when Greenough jangled the doorbell and Mrs. Kitten allowed the members of the delegation inside. Smith was ready and brought the party smartly upstairs to see his work. It was all a terrible disappointment. The men spent only a short while looking, muttering among themselves, offering Smith merely curt pleasantries. They seemed not to be in the slightest bit impressed. In fact, they appeared almost bored. Smith was candour itself. "I scrupled not," he wrote in his diary, "to explain to these gentlemen, I think rather too freely, the order of the strata and the use of fossils so arranged as vouchers of the facts, not knowing but that the new body, the Geological Society, might be inclined to serve me. In all probability, the maps were also opened and explained." I was rather surprised that Sir James Hall could find nothing in such an extensive collection which seemed to please him. A time was fixed for another visit. They came, but I was not to be seen. That first visit had resulted in what was, all told, a humiliating encounter. John Phillips, later reading between the lines of Smith's melancholy diary entry for the day, notes scathingly that the visitors offered him only paltriness and condescension, such as they might have offered a grocer. They walked out within the hour, leaving Smith with the firm impression that he could expect neither help nor sustenance from the society, nor would he ever be invited for membership. The meeting convinced Smith that rigid class distinction lurked deep within the very science of which he was a practitioner. The theory of geology is in the possession of one class of men, the practice in another. That was a polite way of explaining to himself and his friend that he had been most cruelly snubbed. A terrible wrong had been done to him. It would be nearly a quarter of a century before the Geological Society, by then purged of its dilettante beginnings, realized the error and acted dramatically to make amends. But there turned out to be far more darkness and menace about Hall and Greenough's behaviour on that spring day than their mere contemptuous dismissal of their host. Precisely coincident with the encounter with Smith, they embarked on the plan that was eventually destined to ruin him. They decided, and it's not unthinkable to suppose they did so in Greenough's brougham as it clip-clopped back from the Adelphi down to Parliament that lunchtime, that they themselves should also create a great new geological map. They would harness the efforts and expertise of the entire society and its growing core of members. They would make a huge map that would become the official, definitive geological portrait of the nation, and would thereby deal a fatal blow to any further hopes of the ignorant rustic who had been so impertinent as to dare make one first. Moreover, in constructing their new map, they could, if they played their cards shrewdly, have access to the one impeccable source of the information they needed, William Smith's great map itself. They could find additional geological data elsewhere, of course, but the simplest and most direct way to discover the core material needed for their new map, though no one would ever say such a thing openly, would be to copy the very work that Smith was doing. They could turn themselves, unbeknown to Smith, into the very scientific pilferers that he had long suspected were working against him. They could become, in short, cartographic plagiarists. And in short order, this is what, under the leadership of George Bellus Greenough, they became. They saw to it, by means unspecified but certainly devious, that copies of Smith's work fell into their hands. They pored over them, they traced the lines of the strata onto outline maps they had acquired for themselves, and then, year by year, they added information of their own, such that their end result would have the appearance and the utility of something entirely new. Politics, adversity, and misery, it said, each make strange bedfellows. William Smith was to feel the sting of all three, and among his opponents were strange bedfellows indeed. None was stranger, perhaps, than John Fairy, his old friend and pupil from Woburn, who was to become an unwitting conspirator, in the devious process that then unwound. His involvement began when Greenough, who was no map-maker and not really much of a geologist either, became stuck, unable to work out the best way to start work on the map, and turned to John Ferry for help. Greenough did so because, right from the start, his plans for the actual making of his map began to go awry. The cause? Greenough's basic notion that his map should be entirely empirical, and that its drawing should be based only on observations and not tied to any particular theory about which rocks were where, and why and when and how they had been laid down. Rumination, Greenough reasoned, had no place in a geological map. What should appear on the finished sheets of his chart should reflect facts that were quite unsullied by any theoretical presuppositions. There should be nothing on the map, for example, that hinted at any supposed importance of fossils, nothing that suggested, as William Smith was suggesting, that certain rocks could be identified by the fossils contained in them, and that intelligent deductions could be made about the relative ages of the rocks that were so identified. Nothing of this sort was to be allowed on the Greenough map. Following the teaching of those Europeans who clung to the idea that all rocks were precipitated from marine solution, only the results of observation were to be engraved onto his map. Maybe theories would result once the finished product was out there for all to see, but for the time being, observations only. It was a cartographic process that was doomed from the very start, for by denying any knowledge of which rock horizon might be coeval with any other, it swiftly became demonstrably impossible even to think of linking the representation on the map of any one outcrop with any other. And so Greenough, not too proud to concede that he had made a mistake, turned to the one man he knew personally, and whom he suspected might help him, Smith's old pupil, Ferry. The request, which in normal circumstances Ferry might have turned down out of loyalty, actually came at an appropriate moment. Ferry was at the time working on his Derbyshire survey. William Smith, it'll be recalled, had recently fallen out with him for a collection of trifling reasons. He felt that he himself should have won that commission, now offered to his old pupil. He'd reacted petulantly when it was Ferry, not him, who was chosen to supply entries on geology for Rees's new encyclopaedia, and he was furious when references to his own great work on canal surveying were left out of the same book by the editors. Ferry knew only too well that Smith was angry with him, and it would be fascinating to learn that this knowledge contributed in any way to his decision to help Greenough. There's no written record. One can only wonder. But help Greenough, John Ferry most certainly did. He happily showed Greenough samples of his mentor's early works, and explained how it was all being done. He urged Greenough to pay little attention to the European scholars and to Abraham Werner, who made their primitive maps of Europe simply by showing rocks in their arrangements of different types. He'd be far better off, he said, if he followed the unfolding doctrines of William Smith, who matched the strata to their unique assemblages of fossils, and was able to draw maps showing rocks according to their different relative ages. And to illustrate the point to this languid and leisured amateur, Ferry pulled out map after map after map, all of the new, unpublished and unprotected work of the man whom Greenough had publicly and cruelly dismissed. It was a ghastly error. Despite their recent falling out, Smith had always trusted Ferry. He had allowed him to copy his early maps, believing that they'd be used by him privately, never dreaming they would find their way into the planning of a rival publication. When he found out what had happened, he wrote bitterly in a letter to a friend, describing what he saw quite rightly as yet another slight. Ferry, it seems, they thought best to convert into a friend, and he either lent or gave them a one-sheet map of the stratification of the island, a copy, I think he told me, of the uncoloured manuscript one that he had before given to me. And, of course, his copy of Carey's large map, on which he had so many years before been drawing the lines of the strata, was also made use of. And now, as a specimen of the liberality of the leaders of public bodies, for such bodies are generally led by two or three men, I may observe that they deal with Mr. Ferry by making him an honorary member and neglecting me, purposely, it would seem, the better to suit their sinister views. Armed with an abundance of advice, which, though it had come from Fairy, had in essence all come from Smith, the Geological Society began its 12 years of hard grind to produce the rival sheets. Although a committee on maps was formally set up in 1809 to oversee the project, it was widely acknowledged within the Society that it was really Greenough himself, with the help of his boundless personal fortune, who helped see the map to a successful conclusion. Because of this, the rivalry that ensued became highly personal. The battle over the map was as much a fight between William Smith and George Bellus Greenough as it was a battle between Smith and the Society, or between Smith and whatever was thought of as the geological establishment of the day. It was a contest, too, between the ways of a man who was not afraid to get his hands dirty, and the ways of a perfumed flaneur. Smith was the epitome of the practical man, always grubbing around in the earth, draining fields, building water mills, corresponding with engineers about pumping projects, descending deep into coal mines. Greenough, on the other hand, was a young man of leisure whose works were largely confined to the library or the drawing-room, and yet who was blazing a trail for what would soon be reckoned the most exciting and intellectually vital scientific discussion club in Europe. The great map battle can be seen in today's light as a conflict between early geology's doers and its thinkers, between the men of the hammer and the men of the quill. Not, it has to be added, that George Bellus Greenough was ever known for his intellect. He was always thought to have a second-rate mind, but first-rate connections. Greenough aside, this was above all a battle that need never have taken place, and it had ruinous consequences that the Geological Society was later to regret mightily. Now that he had worked out how to make his map, more along Smith's lines and not those of the Europeans, Greenough would have said through gritted teeth, it remained simply for him to acquire the geological data for the engravers. These he acquired from three sources. He read everything he could lay his hands on. He accumulated scores of notebooks full of information as a result of sending out hundreds of official leaflets called geological inquiries, and he went, with his colleagues, into the field. The first two means invariably brought him back to Smith. Many of the small number of English-language books and pamphlets mentioned Smith and his techniques, and scores of the replies from men who responded to the inquiries leaflets also mentioned his name. One woman, our redoubtable Etheldred Bennett of Wiltshire, wrote in response, and her letter is quite typical of what must have been so galling to the bumptious society chairman. "I've never yet been able to get any information here regarding the Crockerton clay," she wrote, "but Sir Charles Blagden informed me that Smith told him it was a hump in the bed of clay beneath the greensand." The third method of collecting information was to go into the field, but Greenough's excursions were very different from Smith's field trips, which involved the map-maker stopping coaches, jumping down into the mud, racing off to hit things with hammers, and collect specimens, and go down shafts, and measure dips and strikes, and perform all the classical tasks of a common geologist. Greenough, on the other hand, wrote in a letter to a Mrs. S. from Richmond in Yorkshire that he would strike out into the countryside and, "as soon as we arrive at an inn, half the inhabitants of the place are put in requisition. Innkeepers, waiters, ostlers, postilions, well-sinkers, masons, gamekeepers, mole-catchers, and these are catechized one after another, and, if their accounts vary, are confronted and cross-examined. Thus we soon become possessed of a vast deal of local information, which we string together as we can, and then determine how much to take on trust, and how much must be verified by our own personal investigation." It was not a method much appreciated by the more pedantic and less gentlemanly of his fellow scientists. When one early sheet of the County of Westmoreland was published in advance of the main map, one critic, the geologist Thomas Webster, said that "Greenough's map I found so very defective and inaccurate that I was obliged to begin de novo." Another critic, named Underwood, who wrote to Thomas Webster as the project reached its conclusion, was even more vituperative. "Greenough considers England as done. This coxcomb's reign must soon be over. The day is gone when a man could pass as a geologist, in consequence of having rattled over 2 or 3,000 miles in a post-chaise, and noted down the answers of paviors, road-menders, brick-makers, and lime-burners, slow and careful investigation, and a profound knowledge of mineralogy and zoology must henceforth characterize the productions of the geologist. Failing that, however, there was, of course, as crib sheet, William Smith's map itself, for the first edition of the great work came out in August 1815, by which time Greenough had still not finished his own work. There is plenty of evidence that he saw and studied the map, circumstantial evidence that he copied from it. Among Greenough's papers held in the Geological Society archives today, there are no fewer than four copies of Smith's completed map. On one of them there are annotations in Greenough's distinctive handwriting. "This sheet is of no further use to the geological map," he had written, leading critics to make the obvious inference that he took all the information that he could from Smith's map and pasted it onto his own, without, it has to be said, any acknowledgement at all. Now that he had the information, it remained only to make the finished map. In February 1813, by then he was probably aware that Smith really was going to finish his task, Greenough paid to have a base map engraved. This work was finished in the summer of 1815, with the entire map, at almost exactly the same scale as Smith's, on six copper sheets. By October 1817 the mountains and the hills had been engraved, by January 1819 the title. Finally, beginning in the spring of 1819, and using the intelligence gained from all those ostlers, paviors, and mole-catchers, and all the data that had been, in the view of Smith and his allies, borrowed, purloined, copied, pilfered, plagiarized, or just plain stolen and taken with no by-your-leave from William Smith, George Bellis Greenough began adding, with delicacy and elegance, it has to be said, the geological information. The lines of strata were drawn on, the colours were chosen, the shading was executed, a quay was constructed, its position was decided. The underside of England and Wales, now officially determined and demarcated by the 13-year-old Geological Society of London, was about to be published. It duly came out, published by Longmans, and distributed by a bookseller named Smith on the Strand, who was, of course, no relation to William Smith. Greenough, aware that Smith's wall map, which was not selling well, was priced at £7, decided to undercut him. He would still make money, he reasoned, if he sold his new map for 6 guineas, and to members of the society, whether they were ordinary, honorary, or foreign, it should be just 5 guineas. Undercutting Smith had an immediate and devastating effect, and it coincided almost exactly with his committal to the debtor's prison. The precise nature of cause and effect can be argued about. The coincidence of events, though, was just too cruel. In any case, the reception of Greenough's map was generally lukewarm, and it sold very poorly. In the first year after its appearance, Longman recorded selling only 76 copies. The critical reaction to it, in fact, rather vindicated Smith's genius. Purchasers said scathingly that there was nothing very new about Greenough's work. There was, despite all the waiting and the expectation, not very much more in this map that had been produced by a society and backed by private wealth than in the predecessor that had been published 5 years earlier by one impoverished man working on his own. "It might well be a useful helpmeet for people travelling to England," wrote one French geologist, A.J.M. Brochon de Villiers, but with characteristically curt Parisian dismissiveness he added, and then underlined for emphasis, "Mais il n'y a rien là pour la science." There was nothing there for science. But whatever the details, this apparently official map was now out before the public, competitively priced, selling for substantially less money than the map on which William Smith had worked for so long, and on which he had long since founded his hopes for security and recognition. Smith had for years been in the deepest financial trouble. For months the public anticipation of the appearance of Greenough's map had so limited his own sales as to effectively ruin him. He suffered both as a consequence of the new map's pricing and because of the confusion caused by the new map's appearance. It confused, for instance, the professor of mineralogy at Cambridge, Edward Clark, a man whose own mind was already a wonderful confusion of interests, filled with information about passions that included zinc, the making of blowtorches, ancient Greek marbles, old coins, the chemistry of Berytes, and the history of the Cossacks. He had long been on the subscription list for Smith's map, but was then told by the Geological Society that another chart was in the works. He wrote to John Carey, Smith's publisher. "When I allowed my name to be added to the list of subscribers to the map you mention, it was under the idea that Mr. Smith was publishing the map of the strata of England, for which the Geological Society have been for so long collecting materials. But I desire it to be distinctly understood that if the map you mention be not published by the Geological Society, and under their auspices, I do not intend to be a subscriber, and in that case Mr. Smith must excuse me for declining the purchase of his map, because I really cannot afford it." When Smith's friends rallied to his side and accused the Society's president of theft, Greenough issued a bleating statement of apology. He had been charged, he wrote, with trespassing upon ground which I knew to be by right of preoccupancy Smith's. The two maps agree in many respects, not because the one has been copied from the other, but because both are correct, and they differ in many not from an unworthy apprehension of my part of being deemed a plagiarist, but because it is impossible that the views, the opportunities, and the reasonings of two persons engaged on the same subject should be invariably the same. Out of what the Geological Society tactlessly called professional courtesy, William Smith was sent a copy of the map that Greenough had, in the view of many, stolen from him. He was presented with it at the cheap inn in which he was then living in Ferrybridge in Yorkshire, where he was taking a respite from the financial trials that had so afflicted him in the capital. He was then almost overwhelmed with financial and domestic difficulties. He had no money, his wife was evidently going insane, he had no job and no apparent future. And now this. The copy, he later wrote in his attempted autobiography, seemed like the ghost of my old map, intruding on business and retirement, and mocking me in the disappointments of a science with which I could scarcely be in temper. It was put out of sight. Nearly half a century was to pass before the Geological Society finally made full amends. They did so in 1865. William Smith himself was long dead. An entirely new generation of geologists now held the reins in Burlington House, men and women who were simply devoted to the betterment of the science, and who were in no way class-obsessed, were not dilettantes, were not given to drawing-room pleasantries and dandyish conceits. Their immediate predecessors had already gone some way to restoring Smith's reputation, but in the specific matter of the map, the Society members of 1865 recognised there was one further step they could take. On all further editions of the Society map, it was unanimously agreed were to appear the following words: "A geological map of England and Wales by G. B. Greenough, Esquire, F.R.S., on the basis of the original map of William Smith, 1815. The Sale of the Century. Well away from the throngs of tourists, in a highly secure back room the size of an aircraft hangar, on the third floor of a modern annex to the great Victorian Palace in South Kensington, that is London's Natural History Museum, are more than 60 rows of cabinets, many of them locked with double doors of steel. Inside the cabinets are hundreds upon hundreds of low and wide mahogany-faced drawers, each labelled, each with polished brass handles. From a distance the drawers look as though they should be in a safe deposit vault, and hold diamonds or the deeds of houses, or maybe an immense collection of antique maps or naval charts. In fact, as befits the biggest natural history museum in Europe, they contain fossils. More than 9 million fossils, ranging from the most complex animals and plants ever known to the merest smudges of discoloration that are said to be the first single-celled hints of ancient life. In the drawers are countless specimens, perfectly selected, impeccably maintained, of once-living matter of all ages and of all types, making up what is possibly the finest and most definitive collection of paleontological remains anywhere in the world. Researchers come from all over the planet to consult what is still an ever-expanding collection, doing so under the congenial invigilation of the staff of specialist curators whose job it is to manage and protect one of Britain's most important and yet most unsung national treasures. Almost all of the fossils have been taken from their original collections, examined and classified and placed, most usefully for researchers, in boxes and drawers according to their age and type. All trilobites have been placed here, all ammonites there, all Jurassic dinosaurs in that section, all Cretaceous echinoids in those drawers, all gymnosperms and conifers and hexacorals in these. There are a very few collections, however, that have been allowed to stay as they were and always have been, collections that have been made by truly great scientists, and which are important today both for the individual fossils they contain, and notably for the overarching historic importance of their having been assembled together in the first place. So, specimens collected and kept by Charles Darwin, for example, are to be found in the museum drawers, as are the entire amassments of early geologists like Sir Roderick Murchison, the fossil sponges of James Bowerbank, and the plants and cetacean bones of James Sowerby, as well as some of the amazing Lyme Regis monsters eased from the Dorset Jurassic by Mary Anning. One of these collections, which still has all the perfect integrity, the same handwritten labels, the same pen and ink sketches, the same accompanying notes as it had when it was handed over, was that which now rests in the 18th row of the cabinets on the museum's third-floor repository, and is so large and extensive that it occupies no fewer than 29 drawers. There are 24 drawers full of fossils, and a further 5 drawers of interesting rocks, all of them carefully amassed and fastidiously catalogued during 30 years of working and travelling by William Smith. Except that there is a difference. While the collections of scientists like Darwin and Sowerby and Murchison came usually to the museum as part of a bequest or as a gift, and at the end of their collectors' lives, William Smith sold his fossils to the museum, and he did so while he was still a middle-aged man. No matter that he had so painstakingly and single-handedly collected all 2,657 of them, it counted for little that his study of them and where they had come from formed the foundation of his theories, of his writings, of his great maps, and of the entire science of stratigraphy that he helped to invent. It seemed to be of no consequence that these thousands of fossils were every bit as important to Smith as though they were part of his very person. The fact is that he sold them all, and he let them vanish into the vaults of the British Museum, and he did so because, quite simply, he had to. For by the time he handed them over, in 1818, William Smith was a deeply desperate man. Ever since the turn of the century, he'd been in financial trouble. A freelance life, which is what he had chosen for himself after being dismissed by the Somerset Coal Canal, inevitably dictates a precarious existence. In Smith's case, it need not have been so. Smith was very good at his job, whether he was called in to make a survey, to drain a field, to prospect for coal, to shore up coastal defences, to repair hot springs, or build a mill, or install a winding engine, he performed his task superbly, easily earning the 2 or 3 guineas that he charged each day, each time adding to his reputation, each time making fresh contacts with men who would give him more and more and yet more work. Moreover, he had some rentable property. The long-ago death of his father meant that he had title to his old cottage and the neighbouring field in Churchill, and when his uncle William had died in 1805, he came into some lands nearby. From both he managed to win an income of about £100 a year. Added to his professional payments, his total income was at times very considerable, and might well have kept him in funds indefinitely. But Smith was a spendthrift, too, spending in large measure in an attempt to gild the impression he would make on the noblemen for whom he so often worked. Not that he spent money on fine clothing, or on entertainment, or wine. His particular vice seems to have been the collection of good addresses, the purchase of the estate at Tucking Mill House, the office at Trim Bridge, the townhouse on Buckingham Street, all grander and more costly premises than necessary, but all with the sufficiency of style and elan that meant he could ask the likes of Sir Joseph Banks to come calling, could entertain the chairman of the Geological Society, or have the Prime Minister himself drop round for tea. The costs of the ceaseless travelling needed for making the map mounted over the years, although in the early days some of these expenses were borne by his clients, as he piggybacked some of his map work on commissions that he won, and quite reasonably. "Everyone who travels," he wrote, "knows that ready money must be provided for the road. There's no credit at the coach offices. A man's hand is constantly draining his pocket, and so pressing for fees were all the lackey attendants, that I used to say a civil answer could scarcely be obtained on the road for less than sixpence. In taxes and tolls alone, the man obliged to travel much pays heavily, however abstemious and economical he may be. No man may take less on the road than I did, for 20 years since I used to go from London to Bath without tasting anything." To compound his woes, and in the saddest of ironies, he also made one celebrated and unpardonable geological error, which was to cost him dear. In 1807, hoping to supplement his income with a steady flow of funds without having to do much work, he bought himself an old quarry on Coombe Down, one of the hills above his home at Tucking Mill. The idea was to prize out of this quarry chunks of high-quality Bath stone, the eolitic limestone then so favoured for building across the country, and which he knew was just then being used to refurbish Henry VIII's tomb in Westminster Abbey. He would take these immense pieces on a small, specially built light railway down to the coal canal, have them band-sawn into building stones, and ship them off on barges to the Kennet and Avon Canal, and thence via the Thames to the masons' shops in London. It took him some while to get the scheme off the ground. To buy the new land, he needed to sell a small part of the Tucking Mill estate. Already he had been obliged to raise a second mortgage from the owner, Mr. Connolly of Midford Castle, to raise the ready money needed to pay for his travels, and that sale took rather more than 4 years. But by 1811 he was ready. He had made £1,330 from selling part of his land, found £500 by mortgaging a little more, ploughed some into paying back rent and taxes, and then paid to have the light railway built and the stone wharves erected on the coal canal's banks. By 1814 stone was being cut, the sawmill was in full swing, and narrow-beamed barges, heavy with William Smith's oolites, were being horse-heaved slowly towards the capital. Good fortune lasted for no more than a year. Two events, one outwardly irrelevant, the other directly related, conspired to put a sudden end to the project. Come the following June, when Smith's map, coincidentally, was all but complete, the Duke of Wellington defeated Napoleon at Waterloo. The wars at last were over, and England was forced to count the cost of all the fighting on the continent. It was a vast sum. The nation went into a prompt and deep financial tailspin. People stopped spending large sums of money. They halted building projects halfway through. They abandoned plans. They deferred decisions. Already, in the spending of comparatively small sums, a new mood of post-war fiscal prudence had settled on the land. One can infer that much from the sparse list of paying subscribers who actually put down the relatively small sums of money that Smith was asking for copies of his map. But in the spending of larger sums, also cut back hugely, the problem for Smith was an even greater one. For, with their new prudence, Britons who had lately been so careless about putting up grand houses and newfangled structures known as office buildings all over the place, all of a sudden stopped doing so. And not only did they put a stop to erecting new real estate, but they also put a stop to buying stone with which to build it. And that suddenly sounded the death knell for the quarry that Smith owned in the hills above Coombe Down. Not that they now would have brought Smith's quarry stone anyway. From 1815 onward, it had become abundantly clear that the Coombe Down quarry possessed an unusual quantity of very poor stone, an outcrop of oolite that was in more ways than one very decidedly inferior. The quarry went immediately and spectacularly bust. The workers were laid off, the railway closed, and left to the rust and the willow herb. And William Smith was swiftly to realise that the hundreds he had spent, and more important, the new mortgages he had incurred, were all for naught. He was spiralling out of control, and it seemed that nothing could be done for him. And not only was he now married to a woman who was by all accounts going spectacularly crazy, he had also taken in tow a relative, a young man who would be his apprentice, helpmeet, and student for most of the rest of his days. He's been mentioned in passing before. He was called John Phillips, and he was William Smith's orphaned teenage nephew. The fact that he would one day go on to be Professor of Geology of Oxford University and President of the Geological Society, astonishing and delightfully ironic testimony to Smith's magic as a teacher and kindly mentor, meant little as the storms began to gather. In 1815, John Phillips was, to put it bluntly, a financial burden to Smith, too. His school fees, £30 a year, and his food and clothing bills alone, can only have added to his uncle's savage decline in fortunes. Twice during 1814, the bailiffs had been to the Buckingham Street doors, hammering for settlement, demanding back taxes and unpaid rent, threatening prison. Twice during that year, Sir Joseph Banks, now convinced that the map he had helped sponsor truly was going to be published, had bailed Smith out with a cheque and a word in the ear of the vexed collectors. Now, come 1815, with the map almost done, with Coombe Down collapsed, with John Phillips in residence, with Connolly of Midford Castle pressing for funds, the situation was far worse than even Sir Joseph could imagine. Smith knew there was only one course of action left open to him, and with this Banks himself concurred. He must sell his fossils, and if not privately, then to His Majesty's government. The negotiations for the sale, which Smith initiated in the summer of 1815, turned out to be painful, humiliating, and protracted in the extreme. They began when Smith asked for help from a Welsh farmer, James Brogden, for whom he had done some drainage work near Kidwelly. Brogden was now a Member of Parliament and Chairman of the Commons Ways and Means Committee. Smith told him of the situation and asked if the government might be able to help. A steady stream of officials then began to call at the Adelphi House to see precisely what was on offer. The fact that the Prime Minister had visited the house that same Easter, and that Sir Joseph Banks was telling everyone in earshot of Smith's eminence, must have helped, for the visitors were a distinguished group. Nicholas Van Sittart, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, came by, as did a wealthy landowner named Sir John Stanley, and one of the Secretaries of the Treasury, Charles Arbuthnot. Smith went back soon after to see Van Sittart at his office in Downing Street. His diary shows that he gazed longingly at the huge Belemnites in the flagstones lying outside the waiting-room window. A few days later, William Huskisson, who had the grand title Surveyor-General of Woods and Forests, made his inspection, as did another MP friend of Smith's, who had employed him on restoring a mill in Kent with the improbable name of Mr. Barn Barn. The conclusion of all of these visitors was that Smith should write a formal memorial to the very Gilbertian-sounding Lords Commissioners of the Treasury, pleading his case. This he did in mid-July, hastily cutting and pasting 9 already printed paragraphs from the brochure that was to accompany his map, and adding simply an exhortation that the government purchase my collection for the British Museum, which would add very much in point of utility to the collection now deposited there, and would, moreover, I trust, afford me means of giving to the public a mass of information which would be found highly interesting and beneficial to almost every class of society. There was at first no reply. Smith waited and waited. By late September, Smith's creditors were becoming less and less patient. He wrote again, imploring the Treasury to help by advancing him £500 or £700, a not unreasonable sum, he thought, since in 1810 Parliament had voted to pay £13,000 to a well-connected aristocrat, Charles Greville, for his collection of allegedly rare and valuable minerals. Still nothing happened, except that in October yet another group of officials and experts, including a chemist called Charles Hatchett, who had discovered a metallic element and named it columbium, descended on Buckingham Street, where they found Smith and his 14-year-old nephew vigorously cleaning the specimens and readying them for valuation. Then at last, in mid-October, the government agreed, in principle, to buy the specimens, and while waiting for a formal valuation, offered Smith an imprest, an advance, of the niggardly sum of £100. Smith bit his tongue, remained respectful, and became firm friends through the good offices once again of Sir Joseph Banks, whose beneficence during Smith's long and tragic story cannot be gainsaid, with an even more influential Treasury official named William Lowndes, who had by chance become a fellow of the Geological Society 2 years before. His friendship turned out to be the key. Over the coming months, as a torrent of letters and memoranda swirled around inside the Treasury, to and from and about a tireless William Smith, working even on Christmas Day, cleaning and cataloguing the collection to make his precious fossils still more acceptable to the government, Lowndes's influence and its limits became clear. Smith, it was finally decided, was to receive the sum of £500 payable in 4 instalments. It was a bitter pill, and Smith was deeply disappointed. He had worked so very hard to persuade the government that his fossils were worth more, 3 times as much as they had offered at the very least. He expected also to be paid for a 118-page catalogue that he and the young John Phillips were creating as a handbook to the collection. But the Treasury was not interested in offering more money, and Smith had to spend yet more funds to have this slim volume published privately. So he and John Phillips then packed up the fossils and, probably with very great sadness, stacked them ready for collection. It took several more months for curators to ready a room, but they never did collect the fossils, and eventually in June 1816, a year after opening that first correspondence with Brogden, it was Smith himself making 3 round-trip journeys from the Strand to Bloomsbury, who finally carried the specimens, the 2,657 fossils, of a total of 693 different species, to their new home. His plight briefly attracted the attentions of the House of Commons. The member for Oxford, a Mr. Lockhart, mourned the extreme parsimony with which the government appeared to treat men of science, particularly a gentleman who by his own discoveries had laid the foundations of geological science, who had for 30 years been cultivating that study and had proved its application to many purposes of public utility. But in the same fulminating speech, Lockhart reminds us all of the limited view that was held by even the most enthusiastic supporters of William Smith and his findings. "The truth of mosaic history," he said, "is incontestably proved by Mr. Smith's geological observations, which provided proof of the account of the creation and deluge in the sacred book." In fact, of course, they did no such thing, though no doubt neither Smith nor his supporters would cavil over a point that, in any event, certainly reflected the prevailing mood of the day. The Bible's teachings were even then still being accepted literally, regarded as gospel truth, by the huge majority of both the public and their legislators. The more rational views of the learned few had still not found widespread acceptance. The more important lesson to be learned from Lockhart's speech is in any case altogether another one. William Smith had, for what it was worth, an ally in the House of Commons, and his desperate situation was at least being talked about in the most important forum in the land. In the short term, such publicity did Smith and his fossils precious little good. And magnificent though the collection is still universally acknowledged to be, Smith's fossils have been seen all too little in the almost 2 centuries since. At first, the museum authorities let them languish in a damp storeroom with few visitors. They balked at the extra expense of putting the specimens in the specially built glass cases they had promised, but instead had Smith come around and arrange them in his old sets of sloping shelves, which he had been asked to carry in from Buckingham Street, a service for which, adroitly, he charged an extra £100. Then everything was moved, more prominently, to the South Sea Room, then back to another room, so neglected that when Smith visited, late in his life, he found his fossils hidden behind piles of junk. Matters did take a distinct turn for the better much later, in 1880, when the museum itself was moved to its present site in South Kensington. By that time, Smith's reputation had soared, and his collection was placed prominently in a gallery of its own, with dozens of his own hand-coloured illustrations in the huge glass display cases. Smith's marble bust dominated the exhibition, and for 80 years his heroic status was commemorated in style. But then again his reputation began to dim, his name became less readily remembered, the details of his curious life unknown. The fossils went back into storage in the late 1970s, and remain there now in a series of drawers, consulted by specialists, but otherwise, like Smith himself, banished to a situation of respectable but little-deserved obscurity. The funds that were brought in by the sale and his subsequent work on the catalogue proved only the shortest-lived of palliatives. Funds went out as swiftly as they came in. After one payment of £100, Smith promptly sent £25 to his brother back in Wiltshire, and then made out a cheque for a further £55 to settle a legal action against him, most probably for debt. And yet none of what was done—no sale, no payment, no loan, no visit to the pawnbroker—could do more than briefly divert the inevitable, could do more than delay the day of reckoning. By the end of 1816, William Smith had no fossil collection, and yet still, more or less, he had no money either. The situation had been alleviated only temporarily. A deep crisis, which was to deepen progressively over the next 3 years, was soon utterly to engulf him. Out of these sad times, however, came two books that added mightily to the impressive list of publications that William Smith was to leave for posterity. Both relate to the specific use of fossils. The first, a four-part work published in 1816 under the title Strata Identified by Organized Fossils, contains 19 beautiful hand-coloured engravings of fossils. William Lowndes, proving himself the firmest of friends, contributed £50 towards its publication. The second, confusingly called The Stratigraphical System of Organized Fossils, and published a year later, is essentially a catalogue of the 3,000 specimens in the British Museum, as the title page put it, with all the hyperbole to which publishers are prey. Neither did any good. Neither book was to help keep at bay the small army of bailiffs, beadles, process servers, apparitors, tipstaffs, and summoners who were now circling vulture-like around William Smith's embattled person. He had suffered much over the preceding years. The clouds had long been building. Now came the deluge.